I was talking to one of your friends about your influences, and he wondered aloud to me, he said, I wonder what Bonnie was listening to. Now, you were born in 1949, and I think I read you got your first guitar around 10 or 11.
I was actually eight. It was a month, like 1958, and I begged for it, and my grandparents and parents bought a Stella under the tree with two different wrapping papers. It was great.
Neat. So, if you could pick songs or artists who really inspired you or influenced you, and I know the list is long, but I'd really like to play some clips of them in this radio show. So, who are a few that?
That would be fantastic. I'd love to pay respect to the people that really got me on the road.
I know. So, who are a few that nudged you in a big way?
Well, I would say early on, because I would go to summer camp when all the college kids in America was wrapped up in the folk revival of the late 50s and early 60s. And I fell in love with the guitar and wanted to be like Joan Baez, who was my, I would say, Odetta. And I remember a wonderful song of my first album of hers called Santiana that was just great. And, of course, we lost her in the last couple of years, and she was a big influence and a wonderful activist as well. And Joan Baez, who was partly Quaker like I am, and just a superhero, and was the reason I sat and learned the guitar till my fingers bled to try to sing all those songs that broke my heart that she would sing.
Mm-hmm. Any favorites of hers?
I would say All My Trials was the first one I learned. But all of those, you know, those first couple of records were just like Bibles to me. And then coming on the heels of that in 1963, when Bob Dylan did The Times They're A-Changin', I mean, I was only 13, so I probably wasn't aware of his first album, but that next record, Times They're A-Changin', really was a life changer for me.
So you were kind of a heady kid then.
Well, you know, like a lot of kids, you get your cues from either your older siblings or, you know, if you have a teacher or if you're lucky to go to some kind of summer camp, which, you know, my dad was on the road every summer. So we went to a Quaker camp in upstate New York, all the way from Los Angeles, my two brothers and I. And a lot of the counselors were college kids from, you know, playing Pete Seeger. You know, Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley was a number one hit by the Kingston Trio, and Harry Belafonte, and, you know, I mean, on the political side, it was Pete Seeger and the Weavers in the vein of Woody Guthrie. And then, of course, Bob Dylan came from that tradition. But, you know, if you were in that subculture of the peace movement and early civil rights movement, where music and activism were married together, that's where I came out of, was through my Quaker background. And it intersected, as it does in my life now, music and politics.
It seems that there's no way to tell your story without acknowledging your connection with Dick Waterman. So tell me a bit about meeting him and how it changed your life plan.
Well, I'd have to say, aside from being John's daughter, John Raitt, one of the greatest singers I've ever heard to this day, my other great gift was my freshman year at Harvard. I met through my friend Jack Fertel. I was introduced to Dick Waterman, who lived in Cambridge, who had been a big fan of folk music and covered the Newport Folk Festival, and then had become a blues fan and was one of the three people that helped rediscover Son House, the father of Delta Blues. And he formed Avalon Productions and had his office there in Cambridge. So he managed Mississippi John Hurt, who unfortunately passed away before I could meet him. But he had Skip James, Mississippi Fred McDowell. He booked a little bit Mance Lipscomb, Sleepy John Estes, brought Buddy Guy and Junior Wells out of Chicago in the mid-60s. And so under that one roof, I was able to meet Big Boy Arthur Crudup, Robert Pete Williams. Fred McDowell and I became very, very close. And when I was a sophomore and wanted to start playing in clubs just to make a little bit of extra money, I took a leave of absence from college to be able to hang out with these great blues artists. It was an opportunity that Dick provided that was just, you know, an unbelievable education, and to get to know them personally and watch them play up close is a gift that keeps giving. I'll tell you that. I mean, I wouldn't be doing this today if it wasn't for the. I was already pretty good on the blues guitar, but I really learned so much from them about the joy of playing.
Right. Yeah, I've read that you said hanging out with them, you didn't learn so much about playing and singing as you learned about hard living and hard drinking and having a good time. But I'm still wondering if you could point me to some of those mentors' music, which, you know, it's like, you know, pretend I'm a friend and you're saying, you know, well, check out Mississippi Fred McDowell's recording of this, to find out and hear something of them in you? You know, call out a song title or two if you can.
Well, for Fred McDowell, I had to wait an album because he passed away. We were going to do a duet on my second album, Give It Up, and he passed away, and it was the first big loss that I'd had in my life, and we were very close, and so I couldn't sing the song until the next third album. I cut the Kokomo medley, and so either of those tunes, you know, Kokomo Blues or Write Me a Few of Your Lines, are two of my favorites of Fred's, and his version, of course, is, you know, will stand the test of time. One of the great artists. Gone too soon.
Well, do you want to, and I know when I ask you to mention one, two, or three, then you're leaving out five, six, and seven, but could you mention a few others that, particularly musically speaking, who, if we listened to them, we could say, you know, all right, I see where Bonnie's coming from these folks.
Absolutely. I mean, while I was living in Cambridge, I stayed there even after I dropped out of school and got a record deal. There was a very vital music scene, as there was an anti-war political scene. The feminist movement was just starting. Chris Smither was already established, and he lived down the street from me and was really a mentor to me. I love his guitar style. And of course, I cut Love Me Like a Man on my second record of his, and I Feel the Same was on my third album. But I would say Chris Smither and John Hammond for guitar styles, that's probably, I would hope that I could be even considered close to the way they play guitar. They were the two strongest influences I had on the guitar.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Has the way that you look for material to record remained mostly the same over the years? Can you paint a picture for us of how that happens?
I would say it is about the same. You know, I would characterize myself as a fan first. I mean, I have not a voracious appetite, but I have a great curiosity for everybody from Les McCann, Eddie Harris, to Mose Allison in the jazz field, to, you know, I love the music my dad does in Broadway shows. I keep an ear to the ground about new great composers and great new shows. Folk music is my first love, I would say. And then, you know, the whole vein of soul music, whether it's old Delta blues or, you know, acoustic blues or Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf or Motown or Ray Charles. To me, funky music is funky music, whether it's out of New Orleans, whether it's Louis Armstrong or Ernie Cato. So I look first to the artists that I love. I listen to radio. I talk to other artists that give me tips on new up-and-coming artists in folk. You know, I heard about Dar Williams and Larry John McNally. I've got my ear to the ground with a lot of DJs that when I do interviews, at the end of the interview, a lot of times I'll ask a journalist or a DJ interviewer, you know, who have you been listening to that really rock, you know, floats your boat. So I do a lot of research and listen to tons of records and CDs. And over the years, it's been cassettes and mixtapes and the kindness of friends sending and turning me on to things. But I like attracts like. So whatever vein of music I'm in, whether it's John Hyatt or Jackson Browne or John Prine, I'm always listening to what they're doing next to see if there's a song that I might want to cover. And then, like, at this point, four decades in, you know, I've got a pretty vast record collection and wider taste that might incorporate, you know, music of, you know, Celtic music and African music. So it's a lot of listening. So it's basically the same process as when I was younger. I just ran through all my favorites the first few albums, which is why I was able to record an album. I think I did six albums in 7 or 8 years early on.
Well, is there any way to say what puts a song in a category of a possible Bonnie Raitt recording?
Boy, I'm sure a lot of publishers have asked me that because they send me songs that either sound a lot like I Can't Make You Love Me or Something to Talk About. And what I don't need is something that sounds too much like something I've already done. And I, whether it's lyrically or musically, I try to keep it interesting for myself. There are certain styles of reggae music and certain feels of kind of a bolero ballad that I've actually, you know, I could probably start singing one of those songs and put the words in from several others and it would fit right in that groove. There's just certain speeds that I like to go at and certain styles of music that I love. But other than that, you know, I can take a lyric and a song that really appeals to me, even if it's not quite in my style, and put it in my style if I love it that much. So there isn't really any rule that I could say when people ask me, you know, is it the lyrics first? Is it the music first? It has to be lyrically something that's very resonates with me personally, and is smart and soulful and clever and, you know, all those things. It just, it's kind of a mysterious process of why a song hits me, but I just know it. And a lot of it is based on what I've already done. And I like this new record. I really wanted to play a kind of a James Brown groove and was looking for a song in that feel, which is why I love Randall Bramlett's writing. And I picked Used to Rule the World for both the lyrics and because it's got that groove. And I wanted to play Right Down the Line in that feel because I just love that place, that reggae rock kind of feel that our band plays. And I'm blessed to have a bunch of players who I've chosen because of their wide range of abilities to cover everything from Cuban music to South African music to Celtic music to New Orleans and the Rolling Stones and Jimi Hendrix, you know. So our sound checks are pretty lively.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the new recordings then and pick, you know, sort of continue this conversation. First of all, in a little bit of odd fun synchronicity, I was pulling out my albums of yours from my album vinyl collection, and when I pulled the whole stack out, I looked to my to the left in the album collection, and then there was Jerry Rafferty's City to City, and I said, well, sure enough, there's Right Down the Line is sitting right next to Bonnie Raitt. Of course it would.
So, how fantastic is that? And here you are interviewing me about that song.
I know, but it was funny to just recognize that that there it is. Now, for a while, you had a familiar cover, what I would call a familiar cover, on most albums. I'd say you got away from that on the last three or four, maybe. But I suppose there are some risks recording familiar tunes. Why this particular one, and why make it the first focus track for your record?
Well, there's when you're well. If in answer to the first part, I had heard Right Down the Line again and was reminded of how much I loved it. Always been a Jerry Rafferty fan. Very underexposed, underappreciated. You know, he's probably got Baker Street stuck in the middle with you and Right Down the Line or what people know from him. And, you know, thank God that there's radio, satellite radio and other radio stations that will play oldies. And I was somewhere and heard that song, immediately knew that I wanted to do it in this feel, a little bit tougher, kind of a reggae lope, which there is a reggae undercurrent in his version, but the way that I play guitar, you know, I listen for songs and know kind of in my head automatically how I'm going to play it. And so I sort of stashed that away before I even found out that he had passed away, which was a heartbreaking thing because I was looking forward to meeting him finally. In terms of whether I think about covers or worry about it, you know, I love Roadrunner. We play it in our show. I love Baby, I Love You that Aretha did. I love, you know, most of the songs I've done of the R&B feel are usually songs that were on original, either obscure or were hit records for, you know, I did I Thank You by Sam and Dave. I did a whole record with Jerry Ragavoy just so I could, you know, cover Ain't Nobody Home. I was funny because in another interview, I was reminded that I had redone, you know, I was playing around with the groove of Love and Happiness when Al Green had first come out with his records, and I was doing Home Plate in 75, and I started to sing out of the blue. I was playing Love and playing the chords, and I started to sing Runaway, Del Shannon's Runaway, to Love and Happiness, and then it was so cool, I decided to put it on the next record. So it's funny that I had another single of that same kind of thing where you take another song and rearrange it. But, you know, in terms of why we picked it first, you know, when I played it for friends, they said, just this is the one that I think, you know, you should open with. We could have done Used to Rule the World, but we'll do that second.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you a little bit about that song later, but let me move on since we're kind of talking about covers. I was thinking that singers fall into two categories, those who have covered Dylan and those who will cover Dylan someday. And I thought you hadn't covered Dylan until the Slipstream record, but then I saw you had on Green Light, which I'd forgotten about.
I actually covered another one on a movie that probably three people saw, which was it was the Abbie Hoffman story called Steal This Movie. I did a version of It's All Over Now, Baby Blue.
Oh, I haven't heard that. Well, I totally get how these two that you chose for Slipstream, Million Miles and Standing in the Doorway, sound like Bonnie Raitt songs, but how did you decide on them?
You know, Joe Henry was the one who first sent me Million Miles, which I love Dylan's last few records especially. I mean, I love all of his records, but the last few have just been galvanizing in terms of his recreating his band with some of the most authentic blues sound and great players. The whole sonics and the lyrics of his last few records have just slayed me. And Million Miles I loved. I loved Time Out of Mind, and I wasn't thinking of covering it, and Joe Henry suggested that. And we actually cut Blind Willie McTell as well, which will be out on the Joe Henry sessions that we're going to put out at another time. And then I went back to when we thought about another song to do when Bill Frisell was out in L.A. again, and the Pariah Band and all of Joe's players were going to be available to go back in. Because we were on a roll, you know, we got 8 or 9 tracks in one day, really across a 2-day period. Patrick and I did God Only Knows the next day. And I love Standing in the Doorway, so I brought that one to the fore. But I don't think I would have thought of covering these latter Dylan songs without Joe Henry's suggestion.
Yeah. Well, not because I wanted to, also on Slipstream, is one of the most sincerely delivered breakup songs I've ever heard. Tell us about the writers, how this one came to you and connected with you, and how you merged with it for this performance.
Well, I agree that it's one of the most amazing in its succinct way of saying this. It's again, as I said, with 19 records, I've recorded a lot of different lyrical ideas as well as musical grooves, and I've been looking for a long time for a song that would have that kind of piercing impact and say something that I hadn't heard before. And Al Anderson, who, of course, I've known for years and years, he was in NRBQ for 20 years, one of my favorite bands of all time, still is. They're going strong in different formulations. But Al left to focus on his songwriting career, at which he's been very successful. And when I was getting ready for Slipstream, I asked him to send me some of his stuff, and I think I got CDs with 2 batches of probably 35 altogether. And one of the songs he sent on its own right after he wrote it was this beautiful ballad that he, I believe, met the singer-songwriter Bonnie Bishop. I wasn't familiar with her, but I sure am now. They wrote this song 45 minutes into me after meeting each other. And he sent it, and I, you know, immediately knew I was going to cut it, although she sang so beautifully on it. You know, Al is just an incredible guitar player, great singer, but an amazing songwriter. And Split Decision was one of the ones I'd stashed along with the Jerry Rafferty song as the ones that I was slated to do with my band. And that was co-written with Gary Nicholson. And there was three Al Anderson songs, but this ballad is truly one of the most beautiful he's ever composed.
Yeah, I had to stop the car. I couldn't even drive and listen to it at the same time. So well done. Well done.
Oh, I'm sorry to make you sad, but I'm really glad it had that effect because for me, I've even asked friends what they bring to what they think the song's about. And for me, you know, I there's a lot of different ways to interpret it, but for me, the idea that the person singing is pulling themselves out of the relationship because they're so messed up and they're not going to be able to get better, and this person deserves better. And that was sort of the point of view that I was singing it from.
To change direction a little bit more broadly, I've talked with people who've been in the studio with you, and they say everything from how in control you are to how chaotic it can be, to it going well, to it being a grind. And I think that's pretty typical descriptions of studio experiences. But tell me how the experience of studio recording has gone for you, how it's changed, if it has at all, over the years.
I'm much more aware of all the reasons why things can sound the way they do. You know, I understand reverb and echo and a lot more about guitar pedals and effects and different sounds and different basses and different. I've always been a complete hound for the sounds of amps and drums and which bass and how the snare sounds. And I'm an acute listener to, you know, the difference between one record, and I was curious about why this one sounded like this, why Exile on Main Street sounds like this, why the Faces sound like that, why this is a record that I don't want to sound like, this is a record that I do. And the records that I love, I went to school on, and, you know, I had a brother that was an sound engineer. I had a boyfriend for 5 years who was a sound engineer. I learned in my 30s really what a lot of how to get the sounds that I wanted in a way that I didn't in my 20s. I just didn't know enough about it. And now I really know I mean, I've always known it's a question of who you get in the room. You don't try to take a guitar player and make him sound like somebody else. You do your homework and get the right people in the room in the first place, and then you just let them go. And in terms of letting live, I like to record live as much as possible on one or two takes and not hammer it into the ground. I don't like to fix things. I like to just let the rawness come in. If you have a great performance and you flubbed a word or you actually missed a fret on the slide and played one half a fret off, fixing that stuff is a way to save, you know, little fixes here and there are a way to save great live performances. So, you know, I know how I want it to sound. It lasts forever, but I don't spend months and months and months on my records. And, you know, I was kind of more at the mercy of the engineer and, you know, the producer's always a partner for me. I never was really, quote-unquote, produced by somebody. It's always a partnership, but certainly more so since my 30s.
Maybe probably the first time I saw you was in a club in Charlotte, North Carolina called Kidnappers, a little small place. It was probably 1985. You sounded good, but I don't remember you looking well and me being a bit surprised by that. Can you reflect a little bit on those turnaround years for you and say what it really took to get fully back on track as you did?
Oh, yeah. You know, I had a lot of kind of confluence of things that happened in the early 80s. You know, when I made a record, it was ready to come out. I was supposed to open for Stevie Ray Vaughan. We booked the video. I had the guy, Robert Hayes, was playing my boyfriend. I got the clothes for the tour. And Warner Brothers dropped Arlo Guthrie, Van Morrison, and myself, and T-Bone Burnett, I think. And I was devastated. We had to pull out of the tour. I had to put my band out of work. I was really upset, really pissed. I'd even gone in and remixed three or four of the songs at the request of the people, although I have a kind of a deal where I didn't have to. And I spent $50,000 of my own money to redo it and remix it. And all the time it turned out that they knew they were probably going to drop me. So, pissed doesn't even begin to say what I was feeling. Within a couple of years, I had a romantic involvement that I was in kind of go sour, and that was also really painful. So somewhere around in there, my knees started to make funny noises when I was running, and the doctor said, if you want to walk when you're 70, you might want to think about another sport. And combination of heartache, rage, and being on the road to make a living, I toured acoustically unless I could play, you know, once in the summer we could tour with the band. Those were not great years. You know, Reagan was in the presidency. The Central American wars were, there was a lot of things politically that were heartbreaking and infuriating for me. It was a downward spiral in terms of my emotional well-being, and that was reflected in my physical well-being. I never let it impact my shows so much, but the lifestyle that worked in my 20s wasn't working in my 30s, and combination of not running and being upset and kind of just, you know, too many nights on the road, too many parties, my what was a recreational hobby turned into something that was a detriment. And I had put on some weight, and I was getting ready to make a record with Prince, and I had enough pride and vanity that I did not want to look like a blimp next to him, who will remain thin the rest of his life and diminutive. So that was the drive for me, was basically to be in shape to shoot this video. And actually, it was a blessing because I realized that, in fact, that I had become addicted to that lifestyle and I really needed to clean up. And at the, not the urging, but at the role model of many people in the same age as I was who had cleaned up, I saw that their lives were a lot more productive. They were still really funky, and they were still funny, and they hadn't turned into moonies. And guess what? I took to it, and it's been 25 years of sobriety. So I wouldn't say that that got in the way of my music, because I luckily for me, I wouldn't be alive if I could have gotten high before I sang, and to the extent that I did later in the evening, you know, after the show was finished. But it's kind of an occupational hazard that the same habits that are fun when you're early youth, they really catch up with you, as the early death of a lot of blues people and country music artists, and Amy Winehouse and Whitney Houston will attest to. It's if you don't watch it, you won't make it.
What did you replace running with?
I just went, you know, walking fast and riding my bike. And now I've been doing yoga for 20 years, so that helps too.
Yeah, good for you. So you did turn it around, certainly. And I know you've talked about the Grammy moments before, but if you'd humor me with it, I watched those clips once again on YouTube. And You know, you were up against some really heavy competition in that first slew of Grammys, you know, the Traveling Wilburys, no less. Every time your face just drops in disbelief. Try to say again what it was like to be in your body that night in 1990.
Well, I would say it was an unreal experience. You know, I mean, I was thrilled to win the Grammy with John Lee Hooker. And we'd already, both of us had had a successful record way beyond anything that we'd done before. So by then, by the afternoon giving out those awards, we were already set, you know. So I didn't expect for a second to win any of the other ones. And, you know, the Grammys at that point was only 5,000 people in that association. And I probably, I don't know if it was Don Henley and Tom Petty or the Wilburys, they probably tied. And I might have eked by like 50 votes. I just broke the tie, I bet. That's what I suspect when it was Album of the Year. But I, you know, when they just kept coming, I just was in a state of disbelief, you know. And I didn't watch that tape for a week or so. But when I see it, I could. It brings it back of how unbelievable. It's really kind of unreal. You don't even believe that it's happening till the next day. I had to look at the Grammys sitting there on my dresser for me to believe that it wasn't a dream.
Let me go back into the discography a little bit, and this is going to be hard if time is running out, but let me do a little bit of this because listeners to my program really love to hear just a little bit of a reflection on some of the songs that are associated with you, I think. And so I'm going to call out some names and just maybe say 20, 30 seconds about you know, what that song means to you or where it came from or what you remember recording it.
Okay.
Starting with the first album, Women Be Wise.
Oh, I was so enamored of Sippy Wallace. I discovered her, that she was had recorded with Little Brother Montgomery and Roosevelt Sykes. I found a record in Dobell's record store in London. I knew I was going to cut Mighty Tight Woman and Women Be Wise. But Women Be Wise probably, like Angel from Montgomery, has the most... I have the most affection for of all the blues songs I've cut, because especially in an era of feminism back there in the early 70s, you know, you weren't supposed to bad rap your sisters. But in fact, we all know, you know, that there's a lot of gossiping going along. There's a lot of both sexes of people stealing each other's. And it made total sense to me that Sippy's giving this advice about, you know, if you got a good man, don't brag about him or don't be surprised if somebody's going to check him out. And to this day, when people ask me about my love life, I quote that song. So thanks to Sippy for having that point of view.
Okay, Finest Lovin' Man, one of your earlier self-penned tunes.
Yeah, you know, I was very in love and wanted to pay tribute to my boyfriend. And I don't write much, but I love singing that one. I don't know what else to say except that I was really proud that I was able to have something that went with how I felt about him. And then to have Junior Wells play on it, I mean, come on, it was fantastic.
So the second album, Give It Up or Let Me Go, is such an incredible listening experience. I'm curious to hear maybe something about that recording session.
You know, that record was a blast from start to finish. I mean, at this point, you know, Michael Cascuna, who was a dear friend of mine, who's ironically his wife, they were divorced, but I wrote Nick of Time, the verse that was the impetus for that song came from Susan. But Kendall Patius was the engineer, and there's a lot of compression on the Give It Up album, which I learned later. When I listened to it again, I'm going, oh, my God, that's such an unusual way to record, but I just love it. I love the way that track sounds. We've never been able to duplicate it live. Lou Turiciano, rest in peace, he was a great Barrel House piano player, played just a seminal part on that. And my friend Jack Vertel, who had introduced me to Dick Waterman, he's on the other National. So it was as much of a party as it sounds like on that record. I'm very proud of it. And I was going to say, I was really, really proud that the Dixie Chicks covered it.
Good. I'm going to talk to Jackson next week. So I want to have you talk about Under the Falling Sky, because it's such an engaging cover. It's my favorite of the ones you've done of his.
Oh, thank you. I'd have to say I agree. I mean, I could sing two albums worth of Jackson songs. That's how much I love his writing. Always have loved him. We're like brother and sister. We met in 1970 and up in Syracuse playing together. I opened for him, and it's just been like that. And like unlike a blood brother, he'll tell me when I'm full of it. You know, I mean, he really can call me. People get a big kick out of our relationship, and to play this with Mark, there was a band called Edison Electric that I met Freebo in, and Mark Jordan played piano. T.J. Tindall was the guitar player. And, of course, doing the record in Woodstock, Paul Butterfield lived there. And to have that band back with Freebo in there and then have Paul play harmonica, he just slayed me on that. And he was one of my heroes. So, you know, once again, to be 22 years old and have the opportunity to play with musicians of this caliber was just incredible. And I love rearranging Jackson's songs. And he'll tell you when you speak to him, I think that, you know, it's really fun for him to hear the little R&B version of things that I put on it. It's just natural to me when I you know, start to play on my guitar, I have to put it through that kind of bluesy thing. It's not conscious. It just comes out that way.
I talked with Billy Payne, too, and his favorite ballad of yours is Love Has No Pride, and you still obviously perform that often now. How is that close to you?
Well, I really fell in love with Eric Kaz's music. I love his versions of all of his songs. Tracy Nelson and Mother Earth did a bunch of his songs. Love Has No Pride that he wrote with Libby Titus was probably the showpiece of my set for all of my 20s. One of the saddest, and for me, when I recorded that song, I had just had my heart broken, so, and the person had disappeared and wasn't, I couldn't reach him. So every night I sang that song on the road, it would be hard to stop the tears from coming. And, you know, nothing hurts as much as when you're in your teens and your 20s.
Well, I don't know if I agree with that completely, but...
Well, yeah, that's true. It's a different kind of crying. It's more devastating later, but boy, when people
that's
said,
right.
"How? What made you think you could sing the blues being that young?" I mean, the biggest... Those early heartbreaks are so excruciating. You know, that's why I picked those ballads.
Okay, let's jump to Angel from Montgomery, which you mentioned briefly before, but why always such an important song for you and your fans, do you think?
One of the greatest songs I've been lucky to record. It's just, you know, I'm such a fan and friend of John's that, like Jackson, it's just hard to imagine growing up without being in that family. And that song just becomes real every night. I sing it for myself going to be that age to remind myself not to let my life be wasted, not to let time go by. I mean, to sing it in my 20s was a different perspective. Every single year that has a different burnishing on it. And to sing it at this point in my life, knowing what it means to me and the fans, it's just that kind of longing and point of view is as powerful as the most amazing play you've ever seen. It's just a perfectly written song, and it feels as incredible today singing it as it did when I first found it.
Talking to Bonnie Raitt, as you know, Bonnie, some people after you won the Grammys said, well, Bonnie's just done what she always did, and now she's just finally getting recognition for it. And I'm wondering about your take on that, outside of being on a new record label at that time and continuing with Capitol for a while. Did something really feel different about the post-Nick of Time sessions and albums from the late 1970s and early 80s sessions that we've been talking about?
You know, each time I worked with a different set of people, you know, Paul Rothchild and his engineer and Fritz Richmond was from the Jug Band was our for one record. Each producer and engineer and set of musicians was equally thrilling to me. I had gone through some difficult period of time in the mid-80s, and my sobriety also dovetailed into, I believe it was AOR radio coming on the scene. VH1 was created. So there was an outlet for roots music and an outlet for someone of my age group that allowed the you know, being on a new label that was enthusiastic, you know, finding a new friendship with Don was. I'd have to say from my point of view, it was as cool for me to work with Jerry Ragavoy and Paul Rothchild as it was for Don was. And, you know, my sobriety happened a couple of years before we made Nick of Time. So by then, my life, I felt like I'd had a rebirth of sorts and a new beginning. But the sessions themselves, every time I make a record, it's as scary and as fun and as rewarding. And I'm not saying that lightly. It's just a great opportunity, and I know how lucky I am to have a deal, you know. So I just felt each record is a clean slate for me. And, you know, I loved working with Mitchell and Chad. The records I did with Don and Ed and the bands from that one, are some of my favorite. But when people ask me what are my favorite records, you know, I love Greenlight. I love Taking My Time. So each record is thrilling to me.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree with you. Like, Greenlight is an album that I just started listening to again, and I need to spend more time with it. So, but that's the long road, isn't it? I lost my mom and an aunt last summer in a couple weeks span.
Oh.
And I know you lost your mom, dad, brother, and a close friend in recent years. I know you said you haven't really explicitly addressed those experiences on your new record, but I couldn't help but hear it, especially in the last track, God Only Knows, with that line, "The world is always beautiful when it's seen in full retreat.
Oh.
The worst of life looks beautiful as it slips away in full retreat." And I know it's Joe Henry's words, but why did they speak to you?
You know, I wasn't consciously trying to channel anything that I've been through the last few years into this music, but my song selection, I'm sure unconsciously, was very informed by the devastation of that, you know, and I'm sorry for your loss as well. I know that at this point in our lives, a lot of us are going through the loss of our parents and the illnesses of friends and losing them. And you just have to, it doesn't get any easier, you know? It just doesn't get any easier. So that song just to me just cuts so deep. And I don't want to, I can't analyze it, but it's really, I agree. I think it speaks to the pain that can only come with the loss of someone, what we've experienced.
You cross over to a point where you find some beauty in it, though. I mean, that's what's so powerful about those words to me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you know, that is one of the most profound songs I've ever heard, and I think I would have been moved by it 10 years ago or 20 years ago as much as I am now. I mean, Joe Henry is an astonishing writer. And when you have an affinity with someone like I do with Jackson or with Joe or John Prine, it's an unspoken connection. But his eloquence, sophistication doesn't cut it. There's an inspiration like there is with Dylan, but this song of Joe's is such a powerful hymn to me that it's a rumination on being at this point in our life and having lived through what we're living through. We have to find some reason to keep going. And there is something, some redemption in it. And there is some transformation that deepens you. And if I could describe it better, I would. But I all I can say is this song just moves me so deeply. And I there was no other place to put it except at the end of this record, and I couldn't wait for the rest of the Joe Henry stuff to put this out. I had to have it on this one. And that probably is because of what I went through, I'm sure. But I wasn't thinking of it that way.
Well, it's perfect punctuation, and let's close there. And Bonnie Raitt, thank you so much for all this time. I wish we could have some more, but I understand. So I'm really honored to have the chance to do this program for you and with you, and I look forward to getting it to you, and just continued success. Thank you very much for everything.
Thank you so much, and I'm sorry for your loss, and I'm really glad that you relate to what I do, because as I said, it takes it you know, there has to be something in you that relates to all the things that I love for you to get what I'm singing about, and that's what music does, and it's the thing that sustains us. With the world as messed up as it is, and as much pain as we're going through, and as much suffering as our friends who are fighting for their lives are, you know, we're living for them. And, you know, as much as I wanted to take a break from it, I know that my job is to lift people up and to move them. And it heals me singing these songs. And I didn't really realize that until I came back. So I'm ready to go, boy. I'm
good. I can tell.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for doing this. I can't tell you what an honor it is that you're doing this for me. Thank you very much.